Larry, I want to start with this Tucker Carlson interview. There are two key moments when he's talking about his interaction with the US presidents, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. When he talks about these two presidents, he says all of the things that were said between the presidents were recused by the team of the presidents of the United States. Who are these people? Are they really more powerful than the president of the United States?
The first answer I would give you is that Bill Clinton was a master equivocator. Bill Clinton would say one thing to one person and quite another thing to another person, and then go away and kind of laugh about it and decide which way he was actually going to go, pretty much on his own, maybe with some counsel from a few people around him. And Bill Clinton is largely responsible. I know he's spending hours and hours now on every media outlet he can get on. I watched him the other night. He went on for about an hour and a half trying to tell people that he was a good president. My experience with him for the 1 year that I was fairly close, because Powell's chairmanship of the Joint Chiefs of Staff overlapped when H.W. Bush was defeated, we had over a year with Bill Clinton. And what I saw was not only a neophyte, I saw a person who often more often than not, got himself into messes, presidential messes. Didn't surprise me, for example, when he had the problems with Monica Lewinsky later, because that was the sort of person he was. And when he started looking at the business of homosexuals, for example, serving in the armed forces openly, he just rammed it right down the chairman's throat. Until the Congress stood up and said, over our dead body. And then he came back to the chairman and said, please get me out of this. Please get me out of this. And that was a foreshadow. We came up on the joint staff with don't ask, don't tell. We didn't want to, but we did because we had to get the president out of the pickle, political pickle he put himself in. His own party was disowning him. And that was an indicator. It was a small affair. Not so small for the politics of it, but it was a small affair, but it indicated how he operated. He would go whole hog on something and then reverse himself as soon as he tested the waters politically. And I think what we encountered with the business of the expansion of NATO, which was started by William Jefferson Clinton, with a committee set up of defense contractors. Who, of course, came back after their deliberations and said, oh, Mr. President, this is a fine idea. Let's expand NATO. We'll sell F-16s to Poland. We'll sell all kinds of things to new members of NATO. It's going to be rich hunting ground. And he also had this problem of being very frightened of his second term's possibility of not existing because a very powerful individual was going to run against him, Colin Powell. Who was being courted by both political parties. That gave him even more emphasis on national security affairs and his bona fides therein. And so he began to push this expansion of NATO fairly dramatically. His Secretary of Defense, William Perry, actually left in part over that issue because Bill was of the same mind we were in the George H.W. Bush administration. In other words, he wanted a partnership with Russia and possible eventual political and military membership in the alliance for Russia, and possibly, maybe down the road, full membership in both alliances, the political alliance and the military alliance. That didn't sit well with an expansion of NATO because everybody knew that if you expanded NATO and you did it whole hog like we've done it now, 31 countries, you were going to make Russia very, very angry. And you were going to isolate them from Europe once again. Russia's made openings to Europe in the past and been blunted and pushed back. This is the latest iteration thereof. Don't ask me why we do it all the time. The Europeans do it all the time, but it seems like we do not like the Russians getting too close to us in any configuration whatsoever, even a disheveled and certainly very little power left Russia, which it was post-Cold War. But that's what happened. And every president since then, notice they're Democrats mostly, until we get to George Bush and the impetus of 9/11 on him and Dick Cheney. They're all doing this. They're all deciding that this is very lucrative. This is very lucrative for our donors in the defense industry. This is very lucrative for us politically. We will make of Russia a new enemy. And she's weak now. And so we can have an enemy that we can handle and just brush off. That was pretty much the attitude. And that's the way we've treated Russia increasingly right up to Minsk and on beyond. When Putin says, we have violated every set of credentials that we established at whatever meeting we had in the process of the aftermath, he's right. He's right. If I were Putin, I wouldn't trust us for a moment. I would not trust our word for a moment. Starting with Jim Baker and Edward Shevardnadze, the foreign minister for Mikhail Gorbachev, and their agreement, and Helmut Kohl's absolute surprise as the Chancellor of Germany. I'll never forget that. He couldn't believe that he was being offered reunification. He was scared of it. That's a fair statement because the Germans predicted it would cost $80 billion U.S. to reunify. Well, it wound up costing about $150 billion. So very expensive, but he was frightened of that. But he was also frightened of what it would mean to Russia for Germany to reunify. When he got the pledge from Gorbachev that it would be all right, that it could happen with some conditions, he was euphoric. And then when he heard that he was going to be able to stay in NATO, he was dumbfounded. This is incredible. All this at one time and in the face of Moscow, and Moscow is accepting it? Well, partly they're accepting it because Shevardnadze and Baker had said a gentleman's agreement, and Bush and Gorbachev agreed to it, that if that happened, NATO would not move one inch further east. And that was the actual gentleman's agreement. Now, we come along with Bill Clinton and the Democrats and those that followed H.W. Bush. They said gentlemen's agreements don't mean anything. Wasn't in a treaty, so it doesn't mean anything. So we can do whatever we want to. Now, it wasn't as if we weren't going to expand NATO probably a little bit anyway. We were talking very much so about the former Warsaw Pact countries, Poland being at the lead. And yes, but it was going to be a long, drawn-out process that made sure they met all the criteria for no corruption to speak of, democratic governments, well-established institutions, well-established. All of these criteria had to be met. We envisioned a decade or so before the first person would, first state would actually come into NATO as a new member. And at the same time, we were tracking Russia. And so there was not going to be any competition there in terms of fear and spheres of influence and everything, because everybody's sphere of influence was going to eventually be Europe, a Europe whole and free for the first time with Russia as a member of it. It didn't happen. And it didn't happen largely because of Bill Clinton and other Democrats who followed him. And then George W. Bush, who kind of picked up on it because he didn't have anything better to do that day. You know, let's make another. Dick Cheney, of course, is the prima donna from the military-industrial complex. And, you know, let's have another enemy. Let's have another enemy because the industrial complex needs it. They were working on China at the same time. But, you know, let's have two of them. Russia's weak. It won't matter. And no one even thought. This is really critical. No one ever thought that we might force an axis between Beijing and Moscow. And that's precisely what we've done.
Putin suggested to George W. Bush to have a unified defense missile system, Russia together with the United States and Europe, which was rejected by the Bush administration. And
yes,
we know that after that, George W. Bush left the ABM treaty. What was the reason behind this decision in the Bush administration?
Money. All you have to do is scratch a Republican and you will find money. Democrats will hide it in their back pocket. But scratch that Republican, you're going to find money. Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, who was like that with Dick Cheney, you couldn't tell their body language. You didn't know who was vice president and who was Secretary of Defense. Been together for a long time. Rumsfeld, of course, had been Secretary of Defense before, and Cheney had been the youngest chief of staff in the White House, 34 years old in the history of the position. They were very close, very close. Cheney knows that if you build ballistic missile defense, you are going to sell that across the panoply of allies and friends like Saudi Arabia, for example, and you're going to make a fortune. I think the last time I checked, it was up to $164, $165 billion that's been paid by various and sundry states and others who want this miraculous ballistic missile defense, which about half the time technologically doesn't work. But it was a great deal, and it made a lot of money. When Bush let Secretary of State Powell know that he was going to essentially abrogate the anti-ballistic missile treaty, we all knew, we were all, you know, Rich was former, the Deputy Secretary of Defense was former military, of course Powell was, I was. We all knew that this was technologically, the promise was not there. And the person who summed it up best was Bill Perry when he was Secretary of Defense. He said, okay, you know, we've never had in the history of air defense an ability to kill more than 0.2 of what's coming in. So let's say he was very simple about it. Let's say 10 missiles are coming in. You're going to kill two of them. Eight are going to make it through. That's engineering reality. That's physical reality. If they're nuclear tips, eight make it through and two don't. What have you done? You haven't been very successful because eight of them made it through, six of which are probably going to work. And you're going to suffer major damage, if not existential damage. So this is not really a good deal. But we sold all our allies and friends a pig and a poke. We sold them a system that cost a fortune and is not all that effective if you put lots of missiles on top of it in particular. It's not all that effective. We did all that for money, to create all this complex out there. Raytheon shares in it, Lockheed Martin shares in it, that was extremely expensive and would make a lot of money come back into the Congress and come back into the White House and come back into people's political campaigns and such as that. Always thinking about the money, always thinking about what it meant. When Powell found out that it was happening as Secretary of State, he immediately went to the president and he said, we have to do something because you are going to piss off Russia big time. You're going to put the entire treaty regime that we built during the Cold War at risk. Look at what we've done. He was right. We've destroyed them all. And he said, I need to go to Moscow and I need to get a treaty with the Russians that will sort of backfill this. And so we got the Moscow Treaty. Just the two pages of a treaty, but it took us further down from the 30,000 warheads we each had. We'd gotten down to roughly 15 or 16 each. It took us on down to 12, 10, and we were going to the bottom floor of the Moscow Treaty was about 2,002 each, I think. We made it down to about 5,000 each, and now we're slowly headed back up again because we derailed all of this. That, to me, is the biggest error, strategic and otherwise, that we made post-Cold War is we didn't follow up. We were destroying Russian warheads. We were destroying them, and we were destroying our own. We derailed all of that, and we also derailed the treaty system that looked after the remaining warheads. We have nothing now, absolutely nothing. And we even have Putin talking about the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, because I think he's made a deal with Xi Jinping. I can't prove this, but I think he has. And I think Xi Jinping is building out his complex and he needs plutonium to build it faster. And so, like the North Koreans have done, he made a little deal with Moscow, and Moscow's probably going to provide, if not already providing him, the plutonium so they can build out really fast and go from 400 to 600 warheads to maybe 5,000 or 6,000 and be the equals of Moscow and Washington. That's what Xi Jinping ultimately wants to do now. And he's probably going to do it. So we have made the world an extraordinarily dangerous place, not just by Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and Libya and Ukraine now and unqualified support for Israel and Gaza, but also because we've taken down that entire architecture of nuclear weapons treaties. We have nothing left.
Just leaving these treaties was supported by both parties?
Ultimately, yeah, you don't, when something's been ratified in the Senate or something's been approved vocally, if you will, in the Congress, you don't take it down with great facility. So you have to have a pretty unified legislature to do that. So what complaints have there been? I mean, on the last one, Congress finally stood up a little bit, SALT. The New Start is what we call it. It's the old vestige of the SALT treaties, but it's New Start, its formal name. And the last time we renewed it, Putin reluctantly came on board. He saw what we had done, and I guess he was just biding his time until we did it to SALT too. And of course, Ukraine did it to SALT because he wasn't going to negotiate it again for another 5-year increment with us doing what we were doing in Ukraine. So that murdered that. And that was the last. That was it. Gone. Everything else is gone. Even the Conventional Forces in Europe treaty, which was a very good treaty too, because it limited conventional arms. Gone.
When Putin started talking about the relationship between Russia and China, he said something so important, two words that were so bold, compromise and cooperation. He said that China's foreign policy is not aggressive, is all about compromise and cooperation. It seems that the United States foreign policy is not seeking some sort of compromise with Russia or China. What's the mindset behind this kind of policy, in your opinion?
The neoconservatives stated it most clearly and most emphatically, and I think they are still infecting the government in a horrendous way. They put it this way in an analogy or a metaphor, whatever you want to call it. We're the king of the hill. We're on top of the mountain. After the Cold War, there was no one to challenge us after Russia fell, as it were. So anytime we see anyone even at the foothills rustling the leaves, we need to bomb them or sanction them or both. That's the neoconservative philosophy. And it's infected both political parties and the entire government establishment. It's still very much there. Victoria Nuland is not just the sole representative of it. They're all over the place. They're in all the federal bureaucracy, and that is their philosophy. If anyone stirs at the foot of that mountain, they don't have to have a gun. They don't have to look like they're going to climb the mountain. Just stir. We're going to bomb you or sanction you or both. That's our strategy. That's the way we have acted, especially since 9/11 gave the neoconservatives a new lease on life and put them in such prominent positions of power.
In the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, we see the era of the United States being the sole superpower. Right now, it seems that the world is changing. Are we getting to the point that Washington understands the necessity of having compromise and cooperation?
I once took a class in university in Shakespeare, and I'll never forget the term that the professor used from time to time to talk about the tragedies in particular, but you can find it elsewhere in Shakespeare too, even in the comedies. The term she used was comeuppance. In other words, that king got his comeuppance when they discovered that he had murdered the previous king. That's what we're looking for. I believe it's coming. I believe that we're in a period right now where we are building the sinews and muscles of the world that is going to give us our comeuppance. Much the way the barbarians flowed into Rome and gave them their comeuppance when the imperial writ was just a little too hard to bear. Going to be a lot different today because very different times. But you take the 2 or 3 billion that we have, people that we have in the world under sanctions. Some of them have been under sanctions for their lives. Take the Cubans, for example. They've been under a blockade in all practical terms for most of their lives. And you've got other countries in the world that have been under our sanctions for half a century or a quarter century. 2 billion plus people. They hate our guts now. You add to that the unqualified to them, and they're just about right, support of the genocide in Gaza that they now attribute to the United States, and you've got another billion people that probably hate our guts. And oh, by the way, I had some communications with friends in Tunisia and Morocco the other day who told me that in every souk and every bar and every bazaar they go into, they hear the 18 and 19-year-olds talking about joining some terrorist group and attacking the United States. Now, a lot of it is bravado, of course, and they don't feel any way to get back. They see people dying, and they're their people, so to speak, and they don't know how to get back at us. But they're also roiling from the fact that the climate change is mostly the responsibility of us and China and Europe, and not theirs. They didn't generate all those greenhouse gases that went up into the atmosphere and are raising temperatures now and making their crops impossible to grow and flooding their countries and such. So they're blaming that on us too. We're going to get our comeuppance. It's coming. It's coming just as surely as it came to every empire ever existing in history. The problem that I have with that is we're going to take a lot of people with us when we go. Economically, our debt is skyrocketed now. $1 trillion is what we're going to be paying in interest payments or default. There'll be no federal discretionary spending in our budget. It will go for the defense budget on the one hand or interest payments on the debt on the other. Even our Congressional Budget Office is turning out reports to this effect and saying we'll be at $40 trillion in aggregate debt in the next decade, decade and a half. This is unsustainable, completely unsustainable. In fact, it's bad all across the globe, largely because of some of our predatory practices and Europe's predatory practices and Israel's predatory practices. We're going to have to declare some kind of national week of debt forgiveness for the world. It's getting so bad. But we've been leading this, and we've been leading it, and we've been dragging our allies around in it, and we've been taking some friends around in it and making a mess of the world economy. And we haven't done anything to remedy it. We haven't built anything to replace the old mild dying structure we built after World War II. And we're just dragging other people into it with us. Well, you can't keep doing that as the world's hegemon, as the world's imperial empire. You can't without really making people angry at you. And we're seeing that now. We're beginning to see the kind of repercussions that we're going to see increasingly, I think, over the next few years. And the climate crisis is going to, the southern border and the Canadian border now, by the way, my friends in Canada tell me there are as many people coming out of Canada now as perhaps are coming across the southern border. Our media is not even focusing on that. And some of them are coming from nations that or states that aren't exactly friendly with us. Not only do we have, what was the number the other day I saw? The number of Chinese that had come across our southern border is extraordinary. If I were the intelligence people or the security people, I'd be going nuts right now. Because if you have 50,000 in there who are from China, there's bound to be a couple in there who don't hold very high opinion of you or are actually working for the Chinese state. This is disaster. And yet, look at what we're doing. Look at what we're doing in our Congress. Look at what we're doing in the White House. We're just continuing to fuel the disaster, whether it's the internal one of debt or whether it's the external one of us supporting wars we shouldn't be supporting. We're just continuing to feed the fire, feed it, and feed it. I've never seen anything like this, except maybe in my lifetime, in my scope of history that I study from 1945 on. I had to go back to our Civil War to find the same kind of potential for dismemberment of the country. But I had to go back to World War I to find the same kind of idiocy amongst a similar number of leaders who were putting together their own death wishes at the same time they thought they were doing good things. I mean, it's not a perfect analogy, but you see it. I like Barbara Tuchman's term that she uses. They were all wooden-headed. Wooden-headed, that's a wonderful term. They had wood instead of brains. That's what we look like today. And to a certain extent, we're dragging our European allies into this morass. I'm listening to Jens Stoltenberg today give the press conference after the Ramstein conference, and someone asked him, do you really think the United States Congress is going to vote positively on this $61 billion package for Ukraine? Oh, of course. Of course they will. I've been in that Congress. I've visited with them. I know those people. They'll vote for it. Yeah. Keep hoping.
Tucker Carlson asked Putin, did you achieve all your objectives? Putin responded that not yet. He talked about the denazification of Ukraine. It seems that it's so important for Russia and Russians. Denazification was mentioned in that agreement in Istanbul.
I'll tell you something else that shows that. I didn't know this until this morning. My son-in-law's birthday, 56th, 57th birthday, was just today. And he told me something I came home and immediately looked at to see if what he'd heard was right. And I think it is. I can't prove it yet, but I think this big attack that Russia conducted on the group that was moving up to relieve some troops around the area Russia has really made some penetration in was Azov Battalion. And they made sure they annihilated it. They just put everything they had on top of it. So, yes, you're right. They feel like that's a fearful group of people.
Is that possible that the United States comes to an agreement on this with Russia?
I think Putin would insist on it. And if that were a showstopper, I'm not so sure we wouldn't at least cosmetically agree. We might not follow up, but we might cosmetically agree. Here's another worrisome thing, and you're probably following this too. You know, the BFD, which German is sort of protect the Constitution, but they're kind of like the FBI. The former head of the BFD, a month ago, I think they switched, if I remember right, the new head of the BFD just made the former head of the BFD, think about this, J. Edgar Hoover type, you know, just made him a person for observation. Because he is immediately gone with all the knowledge he has of the German intelligence system and domestic situation. I mean, he's immediately gone to the Alternative for Germany party. And they just had a court decision in the former East Germany, in the eastern part of Germany, that ruled against one of the more unruly groups, youth groups. It looks a lot like Hitler Youth in that group. And I'm thinking to myself this morning, and we're going over this with a couple of people. Look, we know that 10,000 people a day or a week, I think it was a week, were leaving the GDR to go into West Germany. And they were doing that legally at that time. That's the reason we helped the Germans, the East Germans, build the damn Schadmauer, the Wall of Shame. We helped them build it by not doing anything. We just stood there and watched them build it. Because we knew that the GDR could not sustain itself if that flow continued. Well, you think about it for a moment. Who stayed? Who stayed? Well, a few people tried and even risked their lives, and some lost their lives trying to get out, to be sure. But who stayed and made up the GDR? Who made up the Stasi? Former Nazis. Primarily former Nazis. So they made, as one German said to me, the best communists. They were the bloodthirsty communists in the GDR. Well, that's who we're looking at, in part being the kernel beneath the Alternative for Germany party. So we got problems in Germany beyond the economic problems that are going to unseat this chancellor, I think, eventually. But I'm more worried about those potential Nazis than I am the Nazis in Ukraine.
Zeluzhny was replaced by Sersky. How do you see these changes that has happened in Ukraine?
I don't think it's going to mean much change for the situation on the ground in terms of the war, because I don't think Napoleon could change that at this point. But I do think it was a very smart move by the former commander. I think he is the person most apt to replace Zelensky when he inevitably has to go, either formally through the political process in an election or told by an attack dog like Victoria Nuland, your days are numbered, you need to get out of here. He could be the person who picks up the pieces, resurrects Ukraine on that sort of Finnish model of saying, we stood up to the beast. Look, we did it, and you should be proud of yourselves. Now let's get ready and build our country back and, you know, do what we have to do with referenda in the Eastern Oblast or whatever, and maybe 10 years before they have a real vote to decide whether they want to be independent or go with Russia or stay with Ukraine or whatever. That'll probably be part of the settlement. But we got to have somebody who can do all this from Kyiv in a decent, somewhat honest, somewhat uncorrupt political base, on a political basis. Well, this guy's perfectly positioned to do that. I think he was smiling when he got fired.
Right now in Avdiivka, the situation is not that good for Ukrainians. Yeah, it's terrible. How they can keep this kind of hope in Ukraine that they're going to help them, they're going to send more money and more weapons if Republican Party is not agreeing on that? Why Biden is so sure that he's going to get the help from the United States?
I don't think he's got any choice but to act that way. You know, it, it's he's hoping, winging a prayer, and he's hoping. I wouldn't put it past Biden to use executive orders ultimately, as he's done, to send weaponry. Maybe not the whole $61 billion package, but this guy seems to think he can get away with just about anything when it comes to arming Ukraine, or even more so arming Netanyahu in Israel. And he's defied a lot of Export-Import Control Act rules and regulations. He's defied the Congress, and they don't seem to be possessed of enough moral and physical courage to stand up to him. If this happens in the House, that they don't approve this package ultimately, if it dies, it won't be so much because of good reasoning as it will be because of politics. And the politics is the politics of the Freedom Caucus, basically, Matt Gaetz and that crew. So I don't know. I don't even know if I'll cheer if they stop it. I mean, I think it'll be a good thing ultimately, because it'll tell the American people, hey, look, this is really not something that your political apparatus wants to do for whatever reason. But at the same time, I'm not looking for a victory for those guys, because they are really warped people in my mind.
One of the things that Putin said in this interview was the number of mercenaries in Ukraine. He said the first country is Poland, second is the United States, and the third is Georgians. We never thought that the United States would be the second in terms of the quantity of mercenaries in Ukraine. How is that possible, in your opinion?
I haven't seen any numbers, but what I have heard from people I know, some of whom have been in Ukraine either as observers or, for example, this gentleman who just wrote the really good piece at West Point's Center for the Study of War, I think it's called, on how technology, high technology, does not reduce manpower needs. It actually may be increasing them. And he's got a great piece on it where he talks about following these things around in Ukraine and then computing the manpower, having to support this automated whatever. And it's more. So this idea that you're going to save spaces with technology is nonsense, he says. So that kind of person, an observer who's there to do a job. And then other people who've gone, like you said, to fight. And the latest reports I've got is they're coming home because they think it's over, done. And they don't want to be dead in the done. That's Americans now. I don't know about Georgians and Poles and others, but that's Americans that I'm hearing that about.
When it comes to these differences between BRICS and G7, and when Tucker Carlson started about these differences and who's going to be with BRICS, who's going to be with G7, and Putin said something so important, I think, as a leader. He said, why we do need to fight with each other? Why we cannot cooperate and have our differences? This is coming from a leader that was in this war in Ukraine for 19 months. It was surprising for me.
I think he's being fairly honest in that regard. There are different motivations, probably. I have to suspect he doesn't want this war to go on either. Here's the problem, I think, that we have. We, the United States, we've had this problem for a long time, but it's become acute. We do not deal with states, qua states. We don't deal with any entity in the world that is a Westphalian creation as that. We deal with its leaders. And if we like the humans who constitute its leaders, and that like means they pretty much bow to us most of the time, don't have to scrape, but they do bow. We've handpicked them, like Jens Stoltenberg, for example. That's okay with us. We love that. We can deal with that. But if they don't, if they stand up to us, even if they're a tiny little person, even if they're, you know, Saddam Hussein, or they're Bashar al-Assad, it helps that they're tyrants, you know, and we paint that picture and everything. But that's how we do diplomacy. We don't talk through national interests to a state with national interests too. In fact, these humans that we deal with and we make the devil out of don't have national interests. They just have personal interests. So it's really easy to be spiteful towards them. That's the amazing thing about Netanyahu. He is the most hateful leader on the face of the earth right now. And yet we can deal with Israel as a state and just ignore Netanyahu. That's unlike us. We normally have to vilify the leader, hate the leader, refuse to deal with the leader, go to war with the leader, support proxy wars against the leader, and everything else that we can get rid of. And then we hate the guy who comes in and replaces them, or the gal who comes in and replaces them. That's the way we do it today. We've always had that tendency. In fact, ever since Washington and Jefferson and Franklin dealt with the French and others, we had that tendency to make a person into the state we were dealing with. And if we hated them, that was terrific, because we could really just vilify that person. We do it today to an art form. Putin is Russia, not Russia. We don't even care about Russia. We 11 time zones. Look at a map. Holy mackerel, that country stretches. We don't even care about that. We don't even care. Putin is the person we hate. Putin has to go. Xi Jinping is the person we hate. He has to. There are 1.4, 1.5 billion Chinese. We hate Xi Jinping. We hate Wang Yi a little bit, but Xi Jinping we really hate. That's the way we do things in the world. It's nonsense. It's insanity. But that is us.
Larry, people are talking about that if Hillary had been elected in 2016, the proxy war in Ukraine would have started earlier. Do you think this kind of mindset is logical?
I think we might very well be on the cusp of World War III if Hillary had been elected. I really do. She was one of the most warlike people that she made the, you know, we had a saying in the military forces that if you're going to war, the State Department's going to be the starter, not the Pentagon. Because every time somebody came to be there, political, they're always political. They're not foreign service officers. That's the crazy thing about us. We don't put a foreign service officer into the secretariat. We put political hacks in the secretariat. So we said when Hillary got there, we said, oh man, going to be war after war after war. And what did we do? We did Libya, you know, we wanted to do Syria. We thought the State Department was more so the beginner of war and conflict than the Pentagon. You know, soldiers don't want to fight. They only fight if they have to. They got to risk their lives out there. You know, Madeleine Albright said to Colin, you're always talking about that army. Why can't I use it sometimes? You know, it made him apoplectic. Now, very unfortunately, we have secretaries of defense and military leaders who like this war business. We've bred a whole crop of them. And so they go around pontificating about Ukraine can win. And if we just do this, they can win. Oh, we should go back and get Bashar al-Assad or whatever. The only thing that unifies them is they don't want a nuclear war. I find that to be the case. And that's positive, of course. But they'll go right up to being short of it. And if you really want to scratch a few of them, they'll tell you, well, we'd win a nuclear war. And you look at them, you say, no one wins a nuclear war. Dude, you need to go back and rethink your whole analysis. No one wins a nuclear war. But it's scary. It's scary that the military has grown closer to the State Department's bellicose point of view than the other way around.
The other thing that Putin mentioned in this interview was this, that Russia has no interest in attacking Poland, Latvia. Are Europeans going to change their mindset? Because they, before that, they were talking about, we are preparing to fight Russia.
I think we've got them pretty frightened. And you could say Putin was the product of that, or Putin was the creator of that with his invasion of Ukraine. But I think it's a combination of things. I think the European Union is falling apart. I don't think they ever got their political act together completely. And if they even did, partially, it was becoming more draconian and anti-democratic than anything else. One reason I think Brexit skimped through. I think they have failed again, catastrophically perhaps, in putting 740 million people together in some sort of unified form that can weather the future well. And so we're going to see this fracturing. I've said it many times. We're going to see this fracturing, and it's starting right now with what I think is the most important country in Europe, Germany. It's starting right now. And as I said the other day, look at Erdogan. The southern flank, the southern anchor of NATO, is no anchor and not even really a viable NATO member. And if I were Erdogan right now, and I wanted to restore the Ottoman Empire, which I think is sort of, in a modern sense, part of Erdogan's portfolio, and I was looking at Mohammed bin Salman and the mullahs in Tehran, I would say, never going to unify Shia and Sunni, never going to unify Shia and Sunni, don't want to, want to play them off against one another. I want to be the leader of the Muslim world. It is my dream to be the leader of the Muslim world. I would pick up my army and march down that coastal route through Lebanon and Syria, who wouldn't object a bit, probably join me, and I would defeat the IDF and annihilate it. And then I would say, I am your champion. And you would have an instantaneous Muslim empire, because everyone would flock to his banners, Shia, Sunni, Turkmen, Kurd, even the Kurds would flock to his banners, because he would have done something that meant the Muslim world, the Islamic world, was back and back big time, which is, I think, one of his dreams. Will he do that? What would the United States do if he should do that? That's his big imponderable. He doesn't know. And I don't think he wants to that much in our face at this particular time. But that is something that could have, in a generation past, that could have happened. It could have happened, and it could have reestablished almost overnight an Islamic empire, a Muslim empire, a real one, not an ISIS one, not an Al-Qaeda one, but a real Muslim empire with a real leader, with a real capital, and a real powerful military, all centered in Ankara. And you want to give China some fright, and you want to give Russia some fright, where would that empire ally itself? Because you've got lots of Muslim communities on the southern belly of Russia. And you've got the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province in China. It'd be an interesting development. And I, for one, do not discount it as a possibility in the next quarter century or so. It could happen. And Erdogan won't be around in that time, of course, but certainly he's got the opportunity right now to do something like that. Would it be a positive thing? Would it be a positive thing in the world of power relations and power management? I don't know, but I do think it would balance things a little bit better, because then we would have truly a multipolar world. And then maybe we would have to get to the real issues, climate change and nuclear weapons. And you would breed that paradigm of international relations that I like to call cooperation, collaboration, and comity. You need the comity. You need the harmony. And all the peer powers in the world and those a level beneath them would be working on those two challenges, because those two challenges cannot be met without the majority of the world participating. People look at me, Nima, people look at me and say, those kind of things don't happen anymore. Bull.
Do Netanyahu and his administration understand what you've just said? Because it's so important to consider all of these possibilities in that region.
The arrogance of the Likud and of Netanyahu in particular, and people like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and so forth, just astonishes me every day. They are some of the most arrogant people I have ever confronted in my life. And Netanyahu leads the pack. People tell me, oh, only reason Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and their like is there with Netanyahu is because he needs them in the cold. Damn not. That's not the truth. The truth is they all think alike. Netanyahu's just smoother, more sophisticated, and speaks English.
What's happening right now in Gaza, in Rafah? It seems that the Biden administration, as we know, that they're not happy with the situation, but they're not doing anything about it.
They're doing some things under the cover, I guess I would say, but those things aren't very powerful. They're not influencing Netanyahu at all.
This policy in Gaza is hurting Biden more than anything else, more than any yes. other foreign policy.
I remember something Colin Powell said about Joe Biden when he was waxing eloquent about different members of the Senate. At this particular point, we were talking about Dick Lugar, who was a Republican minority leader at the time of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Biden, who was the majority leader. And then they reversed when the Republicans won the Senate. But he said, I like Joe. He knows things. He talks too much, but that's typical of a congressman. But he knows the issues. He knows the issues. And then he said, looking at the ceiling, I'd never want to see him be president. And I said, well, you know, he wants it. He wants a job. He'll never get it. Wrong, wrong. But he also said later that one of the reasons he had said that was his love of Israel. And we're seeing that now. I think it is Joe Biden at the center of what appears to be, even with AIPAC's influence and money and all the things we always have to consider, I think a lot of it is Joe Biden's relationship with Israel. He's very reluctant to do anything that might mar Israel's existence in any way. And what he's doing, I think, is helping them make themselves disappear, which is the irony of it. What you're doing by not doing what Reagan did, not doing what Bush did, telling the Israelis when they've gone too far and smacking them in the face and getting them to stop, by not doing that, he's sealing Israel's fate, in my view.
This love of Biden that you talked about is for Israel, or is it something that is taken by the Netanyahu administration? They're asking for it.
I think it would be there regardless of the leadership. I don't think that's material to Biden's approach to Israel. I think probably Netanyahu has done the most of any Israeli leader in Biden's life to show him that maybe some of his affection is misplaced. But I think it's still there. And I think it's for the state of Israel and it's for its people. It's not for any particular leader. I can't imagine that Joe Biden really likes Netanyahu at all. I'm pretty sure that what I heard and what Obama sort of said to me in the Roosevelt room, I think he realized that Netanyahu did not like him because he was a black man. I think there's a lot of racism in Netanyahu. I mean, all you got to see the way he's exterminating the Arabs, Arab Palestinians. He's a racist. He's a racist par excellence. And I think most of the really more avid Zionists are racist. They're racist just as surely as we were in this country, the way we treated blacks for so long, or the way we treated the Native Americans. Racist par excellence. Teddy Roosevelt was a racist. I think Obama and Netanyahu personally got along very, very badly. And part of the reason was because Obama was black. Look at the way Netanyahu reacted to the Ethiopian Jews that wanted to come up and settle in Israel.
Yeah, that's telling. How do you find the current state of this conflict in the Red Sea?
It's not very effective, as we've all seen. And it's really running naval stores down that cost lots of money and might be needed elsewhere and aren't really in high production right now and would be difficult to get into high production and are very, very inefficient because when you shoot a $2.8 million Tomahawk at a $50,000, maybe even 3D produced drone, it's not efficient. It's not efficient at all. And I'm hearing something really awkward and strange. The only time the National Security Council has become fundamentally operational and run a theater of conflict out of the White House was Reagan's Iran-Contra deal, if you remember that one, shipping arms down to the Contras to fight the Nicaraguan Sandinistas. Reagan almost got impeached over it. This war in the Red Sea is being run by Jake Sullivan out of the National Security Council. I'm told he's on the phone with admirals afloat, telling them what to do and what not to do. That's a recipe for total disaster. And Biden's going to pay for that big time if it is happening. As soon as someone in the military decides that's a stupid order, I think I'll go back into the chain of command, you know. And I can't see the Navy keeping it up at the pace it's keeping it up, knowing full well what they're doing to themselves. The Navy is so short people right now, it can't even sail some of its ships. It's got Marines in the Eastern Mediterranean who are, we call it ETS, expiration term of service. They're ending their contracts in the all-volunteer force. While they're deployed, they're being backdoor drafted. They're being told they can't come home, so they're being drafted. They're so short people. The Marine General down at Quantico just made a big protest about the Navy not having sufficient shipping to put his MEUs, his Marine Expeditionary Units, amphibious ready groups, ARGs and MEUs, where they should be. We haven't had coverage for some time, and we aren't going to have coverage. That's a real shortfall in terms of our, you know, international policing of the seas, if you will, making sure freedom of navigation and the Straits of Malacca and all that sort of stuff, which I think is an important mission for the Navy. You know, the oceans have been pretty decent to everyone for a long time. And a lot of the reason for that is the U.S. Navy, whether it's Somali pirates or it's terrorists or whatever. A lot of the reason is the U.S. Navy. Well, they're going to find that very hard to do now because they've got so few ships. They're having tremendous recruiting problems, and they are steaming, the term we use, in areas where it's not in our vital national interest to be, like the Red Sea and the Yemenis, because the reason they're doing what they're doing is because of our support for the Israelis in Gaza. They'd stop if we quit supporting the Israelis in Gaza. So the Navy's being bled to death. At sea, it's being bled to death. And this is another part of the bleeding.
Ray McGovern, he said that the future of Biden and his administration is not that bright. It's not good because of their actions they're taking right now in Gaza. How do you see the future of this administration?
I think my gravest concern right now is I'm not sure, you know, we're almost exactly 11 months from the election, and we're that many more months, 3 more months from the inauguration of a new president. I'm not sure this president's going to make it. I'm watching him. I know a lot of the gaffes and such are, you know, highlighted on YouTube or whatever, but I watch him. And I'm really worried about him actually making it coherent, cohesive, lucid through the next 11, 12 months. I really am. And I wonder what will be the fallout from either his own staff finally doing something about it and perhaps using the constitutional provisions to remove him from office, or his own voluntary step down, which would be, I think, more in character with Joe Biden, and turn it over to the vice president for the rest of the term. But all of that is just fraught with crisis potential and problems, domestic problems of the first order. So I hope we make it through these next 11 months without a serious domestic crisis. I think the possibilities are so high, it really worries me.